Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and I will momentarily, let's see if I can move my hands quickly. They shall not leave my arms at any point. And are you on the air with us?
I think so.
Wow, it worked. I'm always surprised when technology works properly. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we're an economics and investment radio program. We would normally say that we are a call-in program, but Elder Baldy here is hogging the airwaves with taking up the only phone line into the office, or
yes,
into the studio.
The Elder Baldy is present digitally in the studio, but he's not present actually. Which is kind of the nature of life in the United States today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we'll be able to see more and more of that as time goes by.
You got some,
you left out the
disclosures?
Little boys and little girls. Yeah, but you left out the little boys and girls.
Yeah, I didn't say good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, because I figure it may actually, if there are boys and girls, it's more like boy and girl or boy or girl listening, because we are not the most exciting entertainment option on a Saturday morning.
Oh, I think we are. It's exciting.
For us, we've got things that we could say incorrectly and cause people to point fingers at us and laugh at us for a long time, but I don't think it's in the same tone of laughter that most elementary school kids do. In fact, this is my 5-year-old daughter has requested that she listen to the radio program a couple of times. So my wife turns on the radio program. My daughter listens for about 30 seconds and says, "All right, turn daddy off now." I think she wishes she had a volume control for me normally.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hey, well, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of the radio program that you're listening to. It is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Not that it's approved or disapproved by the SEC, it's just that's who we're registered with, in Salado, Texas. And the information we provide on this radio program is not investment advice. It is educational information, and there's a world of difference because investment advice is given to individuals based on their specific needs and desires, risk tolerances, and lots of other stuff, whereas information that we provide, educational information, applies to the general public.
Yeah, it's good information. You can use it to make decisions. We're not telling you what decisions to make.
Right. So we're just not going to tell you that such and such is a good investment and this other one is a bad investment.
No, that's a different kind of thing that for people that are held to a different standard than we are professionally.
Those are salespeople.
Yeah, or pure entertainment. So Cramer is pretty well known for telling people what to buy and what to sell on television. Well, he is under a different standard. He doesn't actually give advice to actual people as a fiduciary. If he did, he wouldn't be allowed to say what he says on the air. So.
Let's see. The information we provide has been obtained from sources we deem reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of said information. That was a lawyerly sort of thing.
Yes, and I love how we say said information as if the information wouldn't be said. How else would we get the information across on the
radio?
Well,
it is definitely said information. It's not printed information.
As of written information, as said.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
And
did a lawyer write that for you, or did you write it yourself in attempt for legalese?
I think I just read it from some document that somebody else.
And then you picked it up and carried it along with you ever
since. That was really cool. It's really cool. I mean, I get to say deemed.
You get to say deem and warranty or guarantee, as if there's
yes.
a huge difference between the two.
I have no idea why those words are so important, but the lawyers put it on the bottom of lots of things that come out.
It makes them feel good. They went to college for a long time. They have to have some way of showing you why they went to college.
I guess that makes sense. They spent a lot of money.
Yeah.
We do not pay for this radio program. This is not an infomercial. On the other hand, KTEM and Town Square Media do not pay us to perform this radio program. We do advertise on Town Square Media at KTEM, and ironically, we advertise for the radio program. So you can go figure what goes on there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Well,
but we do this as a public service.
Yeah, that's the bottom line here, is we're doing this for education. We have clients that listen, and that's that. So we get some benefit. Our clients are, those of you that are clients that are listening right now are going, yeah, I listen. So we do get some benefit. We get to communicate with our clients, but we're the whole intent here is to communicate and educate people on a subject that there's a big, I like this word, a dearth of information on economics out there.
Oh, yes.
I deem there to be a dearth.
You mean like the market's nadir that it hit back on March 23rd?
There's a dearth of information on the nadir of the market, yes.
That's true. That's true. And on the, I don't know, there's probably a fancy word for the market's rise since then. You got a fancy word for that? Ascension.
Precipitous ascension.
Precipitous ascent. No, that's kind of backwards, but that's all right.
Precipitous means on the brink of, and it's just a brink in an opposite direction. So if you're going to use a nadir, we could say deer.
Well, let's talk about the market for
let's
a minute.
Let's do it. Yeah. Lots happened.
An odd thing is going on in this odd bear market that's really not a bear market anymore. And I've been 37 years at this, and I've never seen anything like it, and I've read in history, and I've never actually seen anything like this particular market panic. The S&P 500 index rose another 3%, just over 3% this week, closing at 3,044.31. It's over the 3,000 mark. It's only down 5.77% year-to-date, down 10% from its top in February. It's up 36% from its nadir. See, that's where we use the word, in late March. And it's up 10.62% from this time last year. In other words, if you had looked at the market last year and you somehow just swooped forward to today, you would say, oh, well, the market's up 10 point, almost 11%. We really had a good year. And that's really all you need to know. The less often you look at the market, the better it looks.
Unless you didn't look for 10 years and then you looked right in the middle of COVID, you would look if you, people don't look without being aware of what's happening in the world. So they might have a total panic until they looked at where they were 10 years before and go, oh, no, never mind, no problem.
Well, it's interesting. This market panic is really weird. We've broken some records again this week, this month, for the month of May. The market has moved almost perfectly in contrast to the consumer confidence ratio. Consumer confidence indexes are still down. The market is going up, and it's just if you look at the consumer confidence rating, the future, according to the consumer confidence ratings, is down 29% from where it was 3 months ago. In other words, they see a 29% drop in the future economic well-being of themselves. And yet the market, which is a futures measuring, an economic future measuring device as much as anything else, has risen about 36% from that, from the point where we measure from. And that's just, we've never seen such a great diversion to disparity, disparity, that's the word I'm looking for, between those two. This has been an interesting, strange market. The word on the street, we wrote this in the newsletter yesterday, the word on the street, it's anecdotal, is that the market had a big jump at the beginning of this week because the New York Stock Exchange trading floor opened up again.
Right.
Just a bunch of guys running around doing what NASDAQ and the American Stock Exchange does.
Only without
people. Without a bunch of people running around on the floor.
Right.
And I think the symbol of the New York Stock Exchange trading floor, the live auction floor of the New York Stock Exchange, being open again and people actually yelling at each other and yelling at the people who make the markets in an auction, made people feel more confident that something like normalcy is returning. And the other thing, the other market that's really weird this week is oil. You know, oil was trading down below zero a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
It's up to $35.20. It rose 5% for the week, $35.20 a barrel now instead of being sub-zero. And it's like the oil market is ignoring the fact that there are hundreds of millions of barrels of oil sitting in gigantic tanker ships parked around the world.
Yes, but the good news on that front is that that stuff's being offloaded in this process as well. I've got a little piece of news to throw in there. Charter prices for vessels that transport crude oil have dropped 77% from their March peak.
Yep.
So that's a big news, except that they were up 700% before. So we're still above what we were before this. But I have to say this because we're always making fun of headlines. We certainly made fun and enjoyed many of the headlines on the toilet paper shortage, because the number of puns that can be done on the run on toilet paper is quite good. But get this. Charter prices for vessels that transport crude oil have tanked. Oh, dude.
Somebody was having a lot of fun with that one.
Come on. As much as I complain, I enjoy a good pun, or a bad pun, as the case may be. And that's a pretty good one.
The odd man out, and this is probably, the bond market tends to be more realistic than the stock market. It depends on what realism is. And the 10-year note, the 10-year United States Treasury note, in other words, if you loan money to the United States Treasury for 10 years, you get 0.657% per year. That's your interest rate. And we used to say, very recently, we were saying that was too low for a money market fund.
You're right. If we saw a money market paying that rate, we would make recommendations to clients to move, because it meant that the fees inside the mutual fund were probably eating up a big chunk of the return. It's not the case anymore. In fact, many mutual funds that are money market mutual funds are waiving their fees at this low interest rate period. Don't worry, they'll charge them again later.
I don't know how long it's going to be for the interest rates to come back up to the point where they can charge the fees. Because if they were to actually charge the regular fees, in most cases, you'd have to pay the money market fund to hold your money, which is incidentally one of the reasons that we can't, going to negative yield for treasuries would be, I'm not sure what would happen, but it wouldn't be very pleasant in the United States.
No.
An interesting point here, though, is that a year ago, the yield curve was decidedly inverted, meaning the 10, you get more for a 90-day T-bill than you would for, in way of interest rates, than you would for a 10-year note. And it's reversed to where the 10-year note is paying considerably more than the 90-day T-bill.
Considerably, only if you consider...
I mean, well,
today versus 10 years ago.
And the point is, we have a positive yield curve, but the positive yield curve tails in out at about 1.25% for the 30-year Treasury.
So 1.25% for a 30-year loan. That's amazing.
If you loan your money to the United States government for 30 years, they will pay you 1.25% a year.
There you go.
Which is about what we would have expected on a 90-day T-bill a year ago.
Yeah.
But it's positive. It's a positive yield curve. And the positive yield curve is a pretty good predictor. It's not perfect, but it's a pretty good predictor that the market is going to rise and the economy is going to be better 12 to 18 months from now.
Right.
But the Treasury yield curve is saying it's going to be better, but it's not going to be any big boom.
No.
There won't be any high demand for loans. There won't be, interest rates won't go up. Inflation won't go up. The bond market as a whole is saying that inflation is, in essence, dead for the next 30 years.
And we have to warn you, that's an indicator, but it's not always correct. The yield curve being positive so far has been a nice indication that we're not going to have a recession. And the yield curve being negative so far throughout history has been a nice indication that we're about to have a recession. And that's certainly, we had an inverted yield curve. What does that mean? The longer-term rates on longer-term loans, if you were loaning the money to the government for 30 years, those rates, or for 10 years, those rates were lower than some of the shorter term rates. When you say, I'm going to loan the government some 90-day money, they'll pay me back in 90 days. Well, the rates on 10 years were lower than the rates on the short term, which is backwards. That's why we call it inverted. No, it's not why we call it. We call it inverted so that we sound really smart. I think that's the reality of most economic terms. It's an inverted yield curve. And people go, I don't know what that is. So we sound very smart. Well, it's an indicator. Well, all it means is that the bond market, people that are loaning money to the government, that could be your uncle, it could be you, it could be your grandma. The people that are loaning the money to the U.S. government are willing to take a much, much lower interest rate for a long period of time than they would at other time periods. Well, is that an indicator that for 30 years we're going to have a bad economy? It is an indicator. But if we look back at that long-term indicator, we'll find that the bond market has consistently been wrong on that. In 1982, the bond market was making the assumption that we would have runaway inflation for the next three decades. So it's not always right. We have to hold. We take all indications and we look at them and we measure them, but we have to take them with a bit of a grain of salt as well. So it's the salty indicator. Now
it's kind of like the fact that we're now above the 200-day moving average of the S&P 500 stock index, which has historically been an indication that we've crossed over from a bear market to a bull market.
Right. And for those of you that don't know what the 200-day moving average is, congratulations, because nobody really should know what that is. But if you don't know what it is, we'll tell you anyway. It's just the average over the last 200 days the market's been open day by day. So today, if the market were open on a Saturday, we would look at today and 200 or 199 days before and average it to say where would the market be on that average. And we are currently above that average. We just crossed over it. What that means is that the market is considered to be in recovery, full-on recovery, not just necessarily a bounce. Now, it could have a turnaround and go back to falling again, but this is a pretty good indicator that we're in recovery.
And in a normal market, I would say it was a solid indicator, but this market is anything but normal.
Yeah. Why don't you say that three more times? Because we have to underline it.
This market is anything but normal.
Anything but normal right now, and people should be aware of that.
Frankly, there is a risk, and there's a very significant risk. If, as we open up, as the states open up, as Texas has opened up, we see a continuation of an increase in coronavirus infections, which is actually, it isn't a big increase, but what we've seen since the states have opened up is the number of new infections per day is starting to rise again. If it compounds out and rises in a hurry, which is entirely possible if we ignore the precautions like wearing masks and staying 6 feet apart, and in other words, if we think everything's back to normal.
Are you wearing a mask right now?
I'm not out in public.
Well, I didn't ask that. Are you wearing a mask? Dun, dun, dun.
No, I'm not
either.
I'm all by myself. I do wear a mask.
I just did take my mask off to speak on the microphone, though. So.
And there's, by the way, some evidence that has come out that shows that wearing masks does slow the spread of the disease.
Yeah.
Now, the point is, in all of this, if we get the traditional second wave or second tide or second surge of coronavirus and it starts to accelerate and people ignore it and it keeps accelerating and we have to shut the economy back down again, which is entirely possible, then we could run into a real problem. By the way, places that opened up long before the states and the United States have opened up have seen secondary surges of like Singapore has seen secondary surges of infection and had to shut their economy back down again. Now, a second shutdown of the economy would be very, very, very devastating. It would be worse than the first one because everybody's kind of struggling. The companies that have come out of shutdown are still having low customer flows. They've used up a lot of their reserves.
And they use up more reserves just in the act of opening again.
Yes,
they've got to bring people on site. We got to pay hourly wages. You got to clean things up. You got to get things ship-shaped so that you can open up for the public. And to do that again, it's always a big cost for initial openings after a long close.
Now, and we're not saying this is going to happen.
No.
But it's just one of those things to be aware that there is a very real risk that we could wind up with a second shutdown. And if it did, it won't be devastating long-term to the economy, but in the short term, it'll be a real shock.
Right.
Because there seems to be a consensus among a lot of people, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people, that the threat is over and we can just go about our business normally. And there's a very good rationale behind that.
A lot of people have a good rationale behind it, but what is your would you say?
Well, if you look at the percentage of people who have died in the United States from coronavirus compared with, let's say, heart disease,
yeah,
it is so insignificant that it's almost not even worth noting. It's just a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the people in the United States have died from coronavirus.
Yeah, there's 320 million of us here, and there's only 102,900 that have died. So what's the big deal, people are saying? Okay.
And so people are saying that, and this is a very valid way of looking at things. As a matter of fact, I got an email this morning, if I can find it here. Let me open it up. Yes. Said 30% of the population is under 24. 104 million people, 88 of those have died in 2020 from COVID. Now, I think that numbers, that's from the CDC, and they're working off of death certificates, so I don't think that that's a good...
Yeah, CDC is going to be way, way in the lag on this. They'll get their information correct, but it'll be a couple of years before we can really look back and say what happened on the CDC site.
So the numbers are very, very low. As a matter of fact, if you take the percentages of people who have died from COVID, they are fundamentally insignificant. They're way less than 1% of the people. In other words, we have...
Unless you know one of them.
Yeah, well, we've had 100, and as of today, but we've had 102,839 Americans die that we know were from COVID. Now, you have to give a grain of salt to that, because it's probably closer to 150,000 based on what we've seen in the overall death rate. The overall death rate has spiked a lot more than it should have, than can be accounted for with COVID. Now, some of that is people not going to the hospital because they're afraid they're going to catch COVID. But if we follow the pattern when they dug down deep into the death records in Spain and in Italy, they had to raise their numbers, and in China for that matter, they had to raise their numbers by about 50%. Because they found that a lot of people died at home. A lot of people never had any cause of death. They just died.
Right.
They died of pneumonia or unknown cause.
But
it turned out they probably had COVID-19.
Yeah, and what we can say about the official number is a good starting point. So let's give the counter argument to social distancing some time here. Let's cover it.
Well, let's just say that we had the models right now are saying that fit the models that fit the number of deaths we've had so far say that we'll have about 250,000 deaths in this calendar year from COVID-19. That is still only 0.0765% of the population, a negligible number.
Yeah.
And you double the mortality, you can double that.
Say 1.2. It's 0.12. Yeah, 0.12. would be the death rate, percent.
Actually 0.15, but you're pretty close.
Yeah.
It's still an insignificant number.
Except, go ahead.
Except that's more Americans that died in Vietnam and the combined Gulf Wars times 5.
Yeah.
We don't consider that insignificant.
That's important. Let me give the last part of the counter argument, the argument against social distancing. And that is, I've heard this said lots of times, we've got a lot of unemployment. Well, I'm going to give that real numbers. Okay, at the end of May, I'm expecting the numbers to be around 19.8% unemployment, maybe 20%. Let's round it up, 20%. Let's give the argument as much strength as we can. If we get to the most extreme for 2020 that people are expected based on these models, we have a couple hundred thousand people die from the coronavirus, and we have a 20% unemployment rate to keep that from being higher. That means bad case scenario for COVID, 1 out of 200 people die versus 1 out of 5 people lost their jobs. And a lot of people are saying that's too high a price. Now, let's come at this from the other direction. Let's talk about social distancing now. Do you think there's anything more to add to the counter argument?
No, I think that number that you just gave, in a worst case scenario, both sides worst case, 1 in 5 people lose their jobs, lose their means of living other than unemployment, presuming they extend unemployment,
right,
and have their lives damaged, versus 1 in how many die?
1 in 200.
1 in 200 die.
Yeah. And so that concept, it's a pretty valid argument, but if it was an economics class, it would be considered a valid argument only if you were in your first year of economics. Because the cost associated with the person that died is much more long-lasting. If we're going to measure this in economic terms, which is what this argument against social distancing is about, then let's do it in real economics terms. If someone dies in their 20s, and some people have died in their 20s, someone dies in their 30s or their 40s, what's the earning potential of that person during the rest of their career? If someone dies and they're already in a nursing home, the economic impact for the nursing home is very valid. For that industry of the economy, it's very valid because they are still, you know, we're a consumer-driven economy. That's still a consumer situation. They are consuming a service. What is the long-term cost to losing a person that may live for another 10 years in assisted living facility in a comfortable and happy life, paying assistance to help them during that time period? How many jobs would you say would get lost in if we could compact that down to a 6-month period and say the same way we do with the 20% unemployment, say this is the current cost of that, it'd be more like 40% as a cost. The small amount that we're talking about in death, and this is really, it's an esoteric, this is really a conceptual concept, as conceptual as a concept can be, of what is the potential benefit to society for one person being there. And I recommend that there's some good movies to watch on that. It's A Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart. What is the cost of a human life? And from the perspective of free-ranging, large-impact economics, a human life is incalculably expensive because it could be Jeff Bezos who dies before he founds Amazon. It could also be somebody that just leeches off of the unemployment system for the rest of their life. But there's a lot fewer of the second than there are of entrepreneurs. So I would say on the average, there's more entrepreneurs out there than there are unemployed. That's an easy average to prove. What is the cost of somebody dying? And short term, it may not be that big. The long term is what we are all about on this program. We want to look and say, all right, why would we want to pay $20 million to fix a bunch of potholes? What's the point of that? If you look at the cost to tires, for having them pop, there's nowhere near $20 million on tires for a year on that. But it stifles business. So what is the cost of a pothole? It's worth the $20 million long term if you've got enough business to support that road, or you expect to. All right, I'm going to hand it back to you. I kind of soliloquied there for a little bit.
It was good. By the way, there's been several studies now, and they've all come to the same conclusion that the average person, the mean person, which who probably Man, really wasn't all that mean.
I've met some mean people, though.
Yeah, but the mean person, the average person who dies of COVID-19 has 10 more years of life expectancy. That's, so some people are having 20 years, some people are having 5 years, some people have 1 year.
But the average.
The average is 10 years. In other words, you're cutting 10 years off their life. And so that number you gave was probably pretty accurate. And the other thing about COVID that will come out in later studies and people won't pay a lot of attention to it, is for every person who dies of COVID, there are at least two people who suffer long-term disability.
Right. Either scarred lungs or brain damage.
There is a disease that is now becoming more and more understood. After a severe viral infection like COVID, people never recover. They basically remain tired and weak and have a whole series of things that affects their productivity dramatically after they simply had the disease. It doesn't happen to everybody, but for every death, there are at least two of those. So, again, the damage to the economy is pretty severe. The other thing is, we've had 100,000, and we've said this before, but it's important to remember that there's been comparison between the 1986 Hong Kong flu and COVID. The Hong Kong flu killed about 100,000 Americans.
Over 4 years.
But it killed them over 4 years, which is pretty much in the range, the 25,000 range per year, that influenza kills people. Again, it killed older people. It killed sick people. It killed people with respiratory problems, people who were being treated for cancer and had immune system deficiencies. But the point is that it killed them over a four-year period. It didn't kill them in 3 months. We've killed about 100,000 people in about 3 months. And, you know, I say we have. Coronavirus has. And where we go from here is the question. The reason, by the way, that we're not looking at a million people dying this year in the United States, which was a distinct possibility, is because of the social distancing and the shutdown.
Right.
In other words, it's worked so well, we should immediately stop it. And there's a balance there, and I'm very frankly, I'm glad I'm not Governor Abbott. I'm glad I'm not President Trump, trying to make a decision where the balance is between allowing this very infectious and deadly disease to spread and crippling the economy and causing despair and ruining people's lives. It's a hard decision, and I'm glad, very frankly, I'm glad that Governor Abbott is making the decisions he's making. And I'm glad I'm not making those decisions. But there's two arguments. One is, under no circumstances should we open anything up. Everything should remain shut down. And that's generally the argument of the left.
Yeah.
The argument of the right is it's worthless shutting anything down. We need to open everything up again like Sweden did. Sweden never closed everything down. Mm-hmm. By the way, Sweden's economic impact
was the same as if it had closed down.
It's approximately the same economic impact in Sweden as it is in for instance, Denmark or Norway, where they did shut their economies down and close their borders.
And if you look at the infection transmission rate, it was about the same because people voluntarily did it rather than the government saying to do it. I don't think people would voluntarily do it in the United States if the government didn't give them a strong rationale for doing it. And if you don't mind, I'm going to throw this in. I've talked about this a couple of times over the past weeks, but I think it's an important thing to throw in when we're talking about left and right and politics. It seems like, why is it that we have a left and right opinion over a disease? Why is this about conservative versus liberal? Because if you really get drilled down to it, the vast majority of startup companies are leaning liberal. The vast majority of business owners now lean liberal. Yep, you heard me right. There was a shift about 8 years ago where entrepreneurs became more liberal than conservative. And that's a weird thing. We talked about it on the radio at the time. But that's the case now. There's this old concept that the Republicans are the party of business. Well, that's not necessarily the case. So why is there this right-left thing over the economy? And the answer is purely one thing. Now, we can build other concepts around it, but the purely one thing is demographics and the density of population. Now, it sounds like I just went on a tangent, but a very simple question. Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, Austin, Democrat mayors in a strongly Republican state. Why are there Democrat mayors on these big, big cities? Well, very simple answer to that is that the denser the population, the more use that the public gets out of public funds. If you're in a rural community, the county might fix your road, but they're not out there every day. If you're in a city, you see a lot of road construction. The density of population means that you get much more benefit directly from the government, and that includes police action. So the density of population means that the police can respond to a given situation very quickly, which is why you see in a dense population people saying gun rights aren't that important. But if you get back to the rural situation where it takes a long time for the police to get somewhere, gun rights are very important. This is a good balance to have. Okay, simple question, and Elder Baldy, you are welcome to answer this. It's a very, very simple question.
Maybe if it's a simple enough question, I may be able to answer it.
All right. Historically, have plagues, epidemics, and pandemics affected rural populations out in the countryside more or less than urban, densely populated populations?
Well, they affect the densely populated urban areas far more.
Okay. So you have a liberal-leaning concept. When you have a dense population, it's very natural for the good of the many to take precedence over the good of the one. And in a lightly populated area, it's very natural for the good of the one to take precedence over the good of the many, because that implies the good of the many. All right. So now we've got coronavirus, which has a much worse impact in densely populated areas, which are mostly liberal. Of course, they're anti-opening up again. And then you have less densely populated areas where COVID is not having this same kind of logarithmic growth when it gets out of control. And they're saying, we don't even know anybody that's gotten this. Why are we shut down? And this is why it may be vitally important to do this completely unorganized startup that we're doing, which is county level decisions. Because there's counties in Texas that shouldn't have shut down at all, and counties in Texas that still shouldn't be opened up. And as long as we think in the two extremes of there's only a liberal answer or there's only a conservative answer, we don't make a real answer, which is you got to make the decision at the level of the density of population. That's way too bureaucratic a mindset, though. Nobody's going to get elected on that. So it's not very popular.
Well, locally they might be.
Locally they might be. That's true. So that I just wanted to throw in that there's a demographic issue that comes into play, and that's why the political issues exist. This is why there's a conservative and liberal divide over a virus, which viruses don't vote. I hope not, anyway. That would be weird.
But something could go viral and cause a change in the vote.
They do cause people to pass tests, though. And if you had given me a virus at the time I was taking a lot of tests, man, that would have said that I had a positive on my tests. Man, I would have taken you up on that fast.
Makes sense.
But yeah, tongue in cheek there.
Well, we're living in a COVID world.
Yeah.
Somebody should have a song to that effect. We it's driving almost everything that's going on, but we had a dramatic decrease in consumer spending. It fell 13.6% last month.
Yeah.
In April.
At the same time that some other interesting numbers came out.
The household income, because of the checks issued by the government to households, household income rose 10.5% in April. And consumer spending fell 13.6%. The difference between the two, about 24%, appears to have all gone into savings. Now, savings is a combination of paying off debt and putting money in a savings position in a bank or someplace. And so at the same time, we saw the money supply grow at the fastest rate it has ever grown since we've been measuring it, which goes back into the 1960s and 70s. And as a result of that, there's people who say, hey, we're going to have runaway inflation. And I would say, nah, it ain't going to happen. The issue is we have, relative to the economy, we have the largest stock of money, it's called, money supply, dollars that are in savings accounts and money market accounts and checking accounts in the nation. This is the largest percentage we've had since we've been measuring this. But at the same time, over the last 2 months, the PCE rate, which is the purchasing consumer expenditures,
right,
that's it.
Which is what it should flow trippingly from everyone's tongues. Everyone should know about the purchasers consumer.
Is, which is the real inflation rate,
right,
has actually dropped 1%. In other words, prices, as we've had this huge surge in money available to spend, prices have fallen. And somebody, the people are arguing, well, yeah, but they got to come back up again. And the answer is, nah, I don't think so. Because people increase their spending based on their, based on what they believe about the future of their economic aspect. In other
right.
words, if I think I've got a great future and I'm going to get raises at work and my job is secure, I might go out and buy a bunch of extra stuff.
Right.
But if I think, hey, I mean, I've just experienced getting laid off when I never thought I could get laid off, and I've experienced fear before I got this money from the government, and the money from the government is going to stop. Everybody has told me it's going to stop. And, of course, the fact that people know it's going to stop causes them to put it away, put it in their mattress or in the bank or wherever. And I don't know, did anybody actually put money in their mattress?
Not since the Depression, I don't think. It's just not very comfortable. It makes for lumpiness.
But the point is that this money is sitting there in reserve, and that's a plus and a minus. The minus is the fact that it's not getting spent means that economic activity is dropping off pretty fast in the United States. People are not buying things. They're not buying things, particularly large consumer items, washing machines and dryers and cars. They're just not buying them very fast at all. And the end result is that we have a shrinking economy right now,
right?
Which is what we call a recession. As a matter of fact, when the numbers come out for the second quarter, which is just about the end, we're on the last days. Friday was the last working day of
no.
the second quarter.
No.
Monday is?
No.
What is?
You're a month off. June's the end of the second quarter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we'll get okay.
We're only 2 months into it. It seems like. Seems like we're 2 years.
It's been a decade of coronavirus. That's what's going on.
But when we see the negative numbers for the second quarter, when they're finally reported, which will be in July, they will be astonishingly bad. They will be the worst that anyone has ever reported. Matter of fact, I've seen estimates of the annualized number will be around a negative 46%, which will be astonishing. Now, that doesn't really mean it's going to be 46%. It doesn't mean it's going to be 20%.
Right.
It's, in other words, 46% would be about a 12% drop in economic activity.
That's not what I'm seeing. Yeah. Well, I mean, 12% drop is reasonable. I think 13%, 14% drop even might be reasonable for profit.
You think for the gross domestic product?
Yeah. Because we don't include unemployment the same way as business profit and gross domestic product. The reality, though, is that the cash in the system is slightly higher than it was. So cash has been pumped in.
That's, I'm talking about GDP now,
right,
GDP growth.
Right. Well, the cash equivalent to GDP growth occurred, but the GDP growth didn't occur, and that's the thing.
Anyway, we're going to see some really big numbers.
We have to play
for
some
drop
commercials.
In GDP. All right. Annualized numbers I'm talking about.
Yeah.
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 Okay, let's do some commercials and we'll come back to this.
Yeah, we'll talk about this is an important thing because people are going to be shocked when they see the number, and you have to understand the context of the number, and it's not a shocking number. We'll be back
on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, you can't do it verbally at the moment, but you can send an email in to either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And the tpwc.com stands for The Personal Wealth Coach. It's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure.
McClure.
All
we
right.
got that.
Yeah, sort of.
Okay, I got those numbers from GDP Now, which is the Atlanta Fed. They said their latest estimate for second quarter GDP is a negative 51.2%. And Moody's is saying a negative 36%. Now, that's the annualized rate. In other words, if it kept on doing it for 12 months, that's how much it would be. A 40% GDP decline, for example, in one quarter is really only a 10% GDP decline. So there's going to be probably some pretty shocking numbers come out in July. And be ready for them, but that will mark the bottom, not a continuous number. And I think it's going to be really shocking if the Atlanta Fed is right and we have and they reported in the second week of July that GDP declined by 51.2%, which is the way the newspapers normally report it. Man, that will be a shock to our morale. But it really isn't very accurate.
I don't like the idea of annualizing a quarter. It'd be like if we reported the growth in the stock market on a given day by annualizing that return, which means that, let's say, or even for a week, let's say for a week the S&P 500 was up 1% or down 1%. Well, then for 52 weeks, let's annualize that. Well, that's an up or down 52%, and that's a slightly more staggering number. When you see a number like that, it can cause panic. When it comes to GDP, most people don't care about the GDP enough to look at it, and it stays within its normal range of between 1 and on really, really good quarters, you get up to 4. But the reality is it's a quarter of those numbers most of the time. And we talk about that on the program, but when we annualize it, it makes it look better for the headline. Well, it's certainly going to sell a lot of newspapers if you get
a lot of clicks on
52%
like
drop in GDP. But the reality is it's not. The gross domestic product of the United States for the year 2020 will not be half of what it was. It will be much greater than that. But there will be a quarter where it's at half of GDP or somewhere in that vicinity.
No, it won't be. Then, well, the quarter, it's still a 40% drop in GDP, for example, in the quarter, for annualized, is a 10% drop in the actual GDP for the quarter.
That's right.
That's the important thing. When you see those numbers come out, and we're giving you plenty of advance warning, the estimates are already floating around out there. When you see those numbers come out, divide them by 4, and it's hard to know whether you're looking at annualized numbers or actual numbers because of the way they're reported
quite often,
online.
Yeah, quite often.
And
they don't even say. They don't say quarterly, or they said the quarter ending, whatever, we had a change in gross domestic product of 4%. But that's not real. It's a quarter of that. So even in a really, really good year, you don't see a 4% growth in GDP in one quarter. You see a 1% growth multiplied by 4 for 4 quarters.
Ah. And we continue. I tend to continue to agree that we're going to see things look better in the third quarter. One of two things will happen in the third quarter. Either we'll have a decline that's not as severe as the one in the second quarter, which will make us feel that things are still bad, but they're not getting bad as fast as they were getting bad before. We could easily see a positive GDP in the third quarter.
Wait a minute. I have to recognize some brilliance here. You just said, in a way that sounded like you were saying something really important, that one of two things will happen in the third quarter. Either we'll do good or we'll do bad.
That's, well, I think it'll be good either way.
Brilliant.
With 2 months worth of data, the Atlanta Fed is right, and you see a decline of 51% on an annualized basis in the GDP for the second quarter. It's reported in July. 3 months later, they report that the GDP only dropped at an annualized rate of 5%. Well, it's still getting worse. It's just getting worse at a less fast speed,
which right.
makes everybody feel, oh, we're much better off than we were. It's kind of like, under normal circumstances, if we looked at the market and said the market is down, we're almost halfway through the year, and the market is down 5%. Ooh, that's terrible. Of course, if you look at it from a year ago, it's up 10, almost 11%, and that's great. It all depends on how you look at the numbers and how you look at the time. And it's important to put your filters on, because the worst of the bad news, we may be through the worst of this economic impact, and I think we are. I think basically we're at the bottom right now. Things will get better from here. But I also think that the lag in reporting will make it sound like it gets a lot worse in the future than it is today. Of course, all bets are off if we get a second wave. And that's up to us. If we decide to violate the social distancing, we decide to not wear masks, we decide that this is not a threat and we're just going to go on about it. The interesting thing about pandemics is they hit the cities first, but that doesn't mean that they don't hit the rural area. They just hit it later.
That's right. And it's a slower process. But as we're seeing in Latin America, just because your economy doesn't travel by air every day at the same level as a more advanced society, it doesn't mean that you don't get that association and get a very fast spread of a disease after it gets there. It just takes longer.
By the way,
we're about out of time.
Oh, yeah, we are. We'll get more next hour.
Yeah.
This has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah. If you would
like to talk to us off the air, there's a local number with voicemail at 254-947-1111. You can call toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 1-800-914-PLAN. Again, voicemail during the weekend. Real live people still during the week. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We recommend going to the website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where we have recordings of the radio program going back quite a ways. We've got newsletters, we've got philosophy, and you can contact us through a contact form as well. Until next hour, this has been The Personal.